Dakota, the Honorable John K. Hornacek presiding, is now open for the transaction of any business that may legally come before it.
Good morning and welcome to the August 2009 term of the South Dakota Supreme Court. As you can see, our Chief Justice, David Gilbertson, is not present today. He's away on a family medical emergency. However, he will be participating in this case. He has read the briefs and he will be listening to the oral argument at a future time. All right, this is the case of Halbersma versus Halbersma. Am I pronouncing that correctly?
Halbersma, sir.
Halbersma. Right. Thank you. And Ms. Voigt is appearing for the appellant, and Mr. Emerson is appearing for the defendant and appellee. All right, then Ms. Voigt, you may proceed.
Thank you, Justice Hohenkamp. May it please the court and counsel. On August of 2007, this court remanded the original case, which has now been kind of called Halbersma 1 by people, back to the trial court for an equitable division of property with a specific command to take a look at the defendant's indirect contribution to the plaintiff's inherited property. When a remand hearing was conducted, which was conducted in September of 2008, the lower court determined that the indirect contribution that would be due to Lawrence or the dependent, the appellee in this case, would be one-half the value of the inherited home and an extrapolation of $50,000 that he had at one time during the marriage and extrapolated that to what he believed the figure would be now. And it's obviously the appellant's position that there was an abuse of discretion in the court arriving at those two things. To begin with, I think a good place to start with is, I'm not sure if it's Turca or Tursa, but that was a case that was heard by the court right after Halbersma that also dealt with the inclusion or exclusion of inherited property. In that case, Halbersma was cited twice. And I don't know if it's my interpretation, but the language of Tursa appears to say that the individual contribution may be considered by a lower court, whereas in Halbersma, the opinion tended to tell us practitioners that it must be considered. Also in Turca, it was mandated by this court or set forth by this court that the indirect contribution can and not necessarily needs to always occur when the other spouse's work allows the spouse that has the inherited or premarital property to keep that aside or commingle it because it's not needed for the family or it's not needed for the marriage, during the marriage. In other words, for the support and maintenance of the family. Now, that's a little bit of a distinction or a little bit further from what Halbersma went in the appellant's opinion. There are some distinguishing factors between Tursa or Turca and Halbersma, mainly the need for support. In Turca, there was a need for support. And in fact, there was a claim for spousal support. And the trial court gave inherited property to the spouse, the female, the wife that was requesting spousal support, and distinctly said that I'm giving you some inherited property and denying the spousal support because of that. That's not the case in the Halbersma case. Halbersma, we have a marital estate that is worth at least $1 million. That was not the case in Turca. In Halbersma, we don't have a need for support. But probably most importantly, I believe, is that in Turca, there was a need for the inherited property to be used for the family, for the maintenance and support of the family throughout it. There was not in Halbersma. In Halbersma, there was no need for support. The marital estate had a value, It had been invested and was able to keep the family living, and the inheritance that was received by Ms. Halbersma was received 31 years into the marriage. It was a long marriage, 50 years. And there's other distinguishing factors, but the main thing with Tirsa is that it was definitely necessary, and then it was definitely necessary for the support and maintenance of the family. And lastly, the wife was very involved with that inherited property. That inherited property involved, if you may recall, they started a hunting guide service. They purchased some additional land with it. That wasn't the case, as in Halbersma. The trial court did find that there was a de minimis contribution, and although that was found to be clearly erroneous, I think that still goes to the indirect contribution. You know,
at this point, it sounds to me like you're really taking issue with our last decision.
That's all right. Some of us did, too.
Well, and I guess I'm going to get into it. I can't deny that. Okay. I won't deny that.
All right. Well, let's assume we decided it the way we did and move from there.
Okay. And I guess then that leads me to where I was going, Justice Inter, is that I think one of the lines of confusion lies is the indirect contribution. Are we looking at it, the indirect contribution to the property, or are we looking at the indirect contribution to the marriage?
So are you saying we've because of the way we've decided these prior cases in Halbersma, that we've left confusion out there as far as whether the de minimis needs to be to the property or to the estate itself?
Yes, Your Honor.
And we have conflicting opinions on that and conflicting language in our cases?
I believe so, Your Honor. I can tell you from the practitioner point of view that it's almost impossible or darn near impossible anymore to settle. Your settlement negotiations break down. Whoever has the inherited or the premarital property stands for, you know what, Halbersma is fact-specific. It doesn't apply to us. It's very fact-specific, and it doesn't apply to us. However, the person that's on the other side that has the party that says, but we get a share of that. That's what Halbersma says. It doesn't matter what happens to it. You know, we get a share of that. And frankly, what's happening out there is your negotiations are breaking down. You've got clients that are willing to roll the dice or spin the dial and say, you know, what the heck? The judge may include this. And so I think the practitioners, and I can't speak for the bench, but there's some guidance as to what is the indirect contribution that we're talking about.
Well, the majority in this one originally would indicate that it's de minimis to, or it's contribution to the whole estate, which every marriage is going to have that. So then, in effect, it all comes back in all the time.
Well, and I think,
or is there a way that we can write this so that that isn't the case?
I guess that's the question before us today. Is de minimis been negated now? Is there no longer de minimis? Do we not look at the factors that were established in Billion and Novak, which I think in Billion and Novak went clearly to the property? And, you know, it went right to the property. And in Halbersma, it seems more now it's gone back to the marital estate. I mean, we kind of have gone full circle.
So is that why the trial court then brought in the other inherited property of the... When you retried this, then the trial court...
That was brought in sui sponte.
Yes, I understand.
So that was I don't know. That's one of the questions that we had. That was not any... There was a little bit of testimony at trial that I recall on Mr. Halbersma, that he received like $21,000 and then $19,000 10 years later, and that he had just used it. There was a little bit of testimony by Mrs. Halbersma that said it was his inheritance. He said, I couldn't do anything with it. There was testimony that he did use it to buy a new tractor, and it did go back in. But it was sui sponte. It was not part of the initial marital estate. It was commingled into the marital estate during the marriage. And so that was one of the things that was brought in, and I'm not sure why it was brought in by the lower court. I will say that the lower court did not have Turca. I think that does start to give a little bit more insight into where the court wants to go or where we're going with indirect contribution, because indirect contribution started out a long time ago with the housewife, you know, just because she's in the home raising the kids. And that went to the marital estate. And then when we went to, when the case law started to go to premarital and to inherited property, then it was looking at the specific piece of property. What happened with that? What was the intent of the donor? What kind of contact did they have with it? Was it commingled or not? And now with Hilbersma, the billion factors were followed. That's what the court, lower court followed. And now it seems to say that indirect contribution actually goes to the marriage. One of the things that did happen on remand is we did have, and as a side note, I can't help myself, but it would be nice to have some direction on remand, because there's nothing out there as far as statutes. And if you take a look at the transcript, you know, or case law, you can see counsel and the court really floundering, not being sure what we're supposed to do. Are we supposed to take new evidence? Are we not supposed to take new evidence? Regardless, though, the plaintiff did call, the appellant in this case did call the party's daughters to try and address some of the issues of the marital estate, of the position of the marriage that were in the court's first Hilbersma 1 opinion. The daughter testified that the dairy farm had discontinued prior to the inheritance, about 3 years prior to the inheritance. So it wasn't that he was out working long hours. You know, it's still hard. I understand that cattle and raising feed cattle is hard too, but when you come to chores and milking 2-3 times a day versus turning cattle out into a pasture, there's a little bit of a difference. And so there was some testimony from the daughter to maybe try and clear up some of those things, to talk about how the children also participated. She happened to live on the farm after the dairy operation had ceased. She also testified as to when her mother had received the inheritance. There was indications that because of his hard work, she was able to spend time away and go and take care of this land. There was testimony by the daughter that she seldom left, that most of the things were done on the phone. So it wasn't that it was taking her away from the marriage to maintain this property separately.
All right. Well, Ms. Voigt, you're the appellant in this, and I'm trying to determine just which part you appeal, because the trial court, as I read the decision, and correct me if I'm missing something, really excluded, based on probably the evidence that you just went over, excluded from the marital or from the property to be divided everything except the house where both parties were living for a period of time. Isn't that what he decided?
Yes.
Okay, so what are you appealing?
What we're appealing is that in determining what happens on remand, the court didn't look at the 7 property factors. He did not look at those again.
So and you're it, saying that he was excluding the second formula materials that were brought in. So you're contesting the factors as to the division of the marital home. Is that what your appeal is about?
The appeal's about is that he did not apply the property factors, 7 basic property factors, in determining whether half of the marital home should have been, or half of the home they lived in for 3 years, and this inheritance should have been extrapolated. And first of all, to do that, he has to do, or we believe, that the lower court should apply those 7 basic principles and factors that are set forth. He starts to do it in his opinion, but then he stops. And he doesn't go any farther and give any basis, and just in the name of equity or in the sake of equity, he should get half of the value because they lived there for 3 years. But that's not enough.
But to follow up on Justice Severson's question, what are you appealing then? Because you're essentially saying if you would consider the 7 factors, then what, half the value of the house would not come in? Is that what you're saying?
Well, then you have to go... Yes, and then you have to go
so
to the next step.
You're saying based on 7 factors, half the house should not be in.
Based on,
been awarded.
Excuse me. Based on seven factors, and then you have to follow the factors also that are set forth in previous case law on whether there's the inclusion or exclusion of the property. And that didn't get done either by the trial court. Okay, so we have factors that, first of all, to determine, because it did come back that there needs to be an equitable division of the property with a look at giving the defendant an indirect contribution. First of all, to get an equitable division of property of the entire marital estate, you need to look at all of those, and especially when you're taking an asset now that you had excluded and you're now putting it into the marital estate, you need to look at those factors again and tell us how it supports that. That didn't get done. Okay? And then secondly, now you also, I believe, need to go and you need to take a look at the billion or the factors that are looked at in Novak on the inclusion or exclusion and of premarital or inherited property and take a look at why it should be included and tell us through those factors why it should be included. And the inheritance, the position on the inheritance, which I think ended up being $147,000 of what was awarded, you know, our reason for appealing on that is that it's sui sponte. It wasn't anything that was ever brought up at trial other than brief testimony. It wasn't a marital estate, and it was commingled, and it was dissipated. It was no longer in existence, even at the time of trial. You know, the home, they lived in there for 3 years. That was 6% of the marriage. Now, I know we don't go by mathematical formulas, but if you don't tell me the rest of the factors, or if you don't use the rest of the factors to support why that's an equitable division, then you don't have what you need to make a sound decision.
Are all of those factors relevant to this case?
A lot of them are. The age, you know, I think the duration. And I don't know, you know, the duration of the party, the asset, the income-producing assets. For instance, in the marital side, Mr. Helbersma received the Red Willow contract. That's going to be another $60,000 every year for the next 3-4 years. Whereas on the income-producing side, the plaintiff fell short. Granted, the home may not be an income-producing asset, but that's why you need to look at all of those factors. That's why the courts have throughout the years set all of those factors so that we can get an equitable division. And I think some of the confusion lies also now is de minimis thrown out the window? Do we no longer have de minimis contribution? Do we not even take a look at that? Has indirect contribution replaced that? Or is that maybe another factor you look at? If you find that there has not been de minimis contribution and it was needed for the family and maintenance of the support of the family, do you then go the next step and find the indirect contribution?
So just remind me, does the circuit court refer to de minimis in the remand?
He does not. I believe the only time he does is he gave credit for the $7,500 that he had originally given him as de minimis against the half of the house. But he does go through a lot of the reasons for finding de minimis in his opinion and uses that as an attempt at support of why maybe he doesn't give the defendant more. You know, I don't know if there need to be more factors or if there need to be factors in itself that are set forth for indirect contribution, you know, such as when it came into the marriage, how was it used in the marriage, what was the party's contributions, what role did the assets play during the marriage? I don't know. But right now, I know that there's confusion out there.
So what you are asking this court is to come up with a more understandable or more concrete rule so the practitioners can and the public can know where they're going? Is that what you're asking?
If I may be so bold, yes. Yes. I there's confusion out there on what to do with inherited and premarital property. Is it automatically thrown in and we take a look at indirect? And again, the indirect contribution, you know, when we've looked, when the court's looked at inherited property, whether it should be excluded or included in the past, has kind of gone to the property, to the piece of property. And what's occurred with that piece of property? Has it been commingled? Have they had any participation in it? Did they know about it? Did they care about it? Those kind of factors. I don't mean to be glib, but in essence. And now we've kind of gone, so does that indirect contribution go to this Mr. Helbersma's indirect contribution? Is that, it appears, to the marriage. And so now we're back to the marriage. So where does that fall? Does that fall under the original thing that happens? Does it happen after we decide whether property is included or excluded? Is it in the original? Maybe now we have 8 factors to start out with instead of 7 factors. Although that is set by statute 25-44, but now as a court, you know. So it when most of the case law was Novak, Tirsa, Billion, all of those went and looked specifically at the property and what was happening with that property. And Helbersma seems to have kind of turned a corner and takes a look at the indirect contribution to the marriage. And I'm not going to pretend to be able to tell the court where that indirect contribution should be considered or when, but I think some guidance to the practitioners needs to be given in that area.
Thank you, Ms. Voigt.
Thank you.
Mr. Emerson. You may proceed.
May it please the court, counsel. I think that the first thing we need to do is we do need to understand what is the scope of this appeal. This appeal is about what happened in the remand proceeding, not the trial. The trial has already been reviewed. The law of the case has been set. And the remand proceeding was conducted in the context of the law of the case that's already been.
But was there confusion on the original opinion on whether you take in de minimis or the indirect contribution to the entire estate? Was there some confusion left by the original?
I don't think so, Your Honor. Billion v. Billion established a 2-prong test. That 2-prong test says that if a spouse has made no or de minimis contribution to the acquisition or maintenance of a particular asset, and there is no need for support. Those are the 2 prongs that have to be considered in determining whether property is set aside as separate. This court already indicated in the prior appeal in Halbersma 1 that his contribution was valuable. That particular, because of the use of the conjunction and in the 2-prong test, if one prong fails, the entire test fails. In this particular instance, because of the law of the case, the Billion factor test is no longer applicable. The emphasis on Billion in this particular appeal, in my view, is somewhat irrelevant.
Well, you say it's a 2-prong test. Both need to show, to exclude a de minimis contribution or no contribution, and a need for support?
That's the language that this court has used.
All right. In this case, with the size of the estate, where was the need for the support?
I don't think that the court really needed to get there anymore. I mean, I think that we're getting outside of the purpose of this appeal. This court said that his contribution was more than de minimis, that it was valuable. Because that his contribution is no longer can be viewed as de minimis, we no longer have to go to the next step because that first prong has already failed. The application of the Billion test does not apply here.
Yeah, but then why would we have sent the case back the first time?
You sent the case back because there was property that was excluded, and you sent it back so that all of the property could now be allocated or divided by the trial court under the premise that the contribution by Mr. Helbersma was to be deemed valuable.
It was only with respect to the inherited property. That was all that it was sent back for.
And that's correct. And the remand language was specifically that it was reversed and remanded to determine an equitable division of property that includes Barbara's inherited property.
Well, are you saying that that says you have to include it in the division, or it's concluded in the consideration by the court in applying all of the factors?
I think that it's included for division is the way that I read that particular language. I think
well,
that it was
going to be reviewed an equitable division of the property. And property isn't property what we're talking about, the marital property? Isn't this saying that a portion of this could be included in the marital property, and then the court makes a decision on how to divide it? You're saying your position is that you absolutely have to make a division of the inherited property?
I think that's exactly what it says, that in its determination of equitable property, it must consider for division the inherited property, which was previously excluded. That was something that did not occur in the context of the first of the trial. It was completely taken out of the picture. It was not part of the equitable division at all. We went up on appeal. This court said that the trial court abused its discretion for failing to recognize Mr. Halbersma's indirect, valuable and indirect contribution, thereby saying, listen, when you take this back, you've got to redo it, and you have to also consider for division the inherited property. That's the way I read the plain language of that particular opinion.
So did we turn the corner and now say that all inherited property has to be part of the marital property?
I don't think so. I think that the court still has to apply the Billion test. And I think that there is some confusion about, well, what is de minimis, define de minimis, and let's put out these new supplemental factors to define what de minimis is. I don't think we need to go there because the specific facts of the case, of each particular case, is going to determine whether the contribution is de minimis or not. That's what's going to be controlling is the facts of each case. And this court has said in the past that each case must be decided on its own facts. I don't think that Halbersma necessarily created new law to that effect to confuse the practitioner. Practitioners still know that the seven principal factors stand. And in terms of dealing with premarital or inherited properties, we still look to the Billion two-prong test to determine whether it should be included in the court's consideration. And that test is going to be dependent upon the specific facts of that particular case. I think what Ms. Voigt is arguing is that the facts of each case should become factors. And that, I think, is inappropriate because you're going to create a much more diaphanous set of factors for practitioners in the bench if you do that. I think that, yes, you can't ever tell a client that it's going to be included or excluded because that's a fact-finding mission for the trier of fact. And in divorces, that's going to be the trial court. In terms of the context of how we believe the trial court should have looked at this is that, again, we look at what we consider to be the beacon language used by this court, and that is that Lawrence's contribution was no less significant than that of Barbara in relation to the inherited property. That language is specifically related to the inherited property. So I think that that creates kind of a level of parity. I'm not going to call it equal, because I think that's for the court's determination, the trial court. But there was a level of parity.
Well, going back to how the trial court should have looked at this issue then, are you're saying that the whether or not the contribution of a spouse should be, whether or not that's considered, we need to look at that as to whether or not it's de minimis or not. So, and that's a fact issue for the court. If the trial court in this case decided that it is a de minimis contribution, isn't that a fact issue that he could have? This decision just says it has to go back and the trial court look at it. Couldn't the trial court then, under your rationale, look at it and say, okay, it was de minimis?
I don't read the opinion that way, respectfully.
So you're saying that the appellate court made a factual decision?
I think that it said that he was clearly erroneous in that particular fact. I think that's what the decision says, is that he was clearly erroneous.
Was he clearly erroneous in that fact or in not considering that fact?
I think that the way that I read the opinion, Your Honor, is that the court was clearly erroneous in determining that Lawrence's indirect contribution was de minimis. And so that's already been established on the remand, is that Lawrence's contribution was not de minimis, it was valuable. And that was the context that we were conducting the remand proceeding. That is the context that if you look at the trial court's memorandum opinion and how it viewed it. And as I see it, because the language used by this court in reversing that particular finding of fact and saying that he had a contribution that was no less significant than that of Barbara, it established some kind of a benchmark that says, hey, let's put these people on some equal footing here, and then you decide, based on the rest of the case or any evidence that you're going to take, how we're going to move around on that benchmark. And what the court ultimately did is, in the context of that case, still said, hey, you're going to get 15%, Mr. Halbersma. Barbara, you're going to get 85% of that previously excluded property, and the property for which the appellate court has already determined your contribution was no less significant. And that is our position, in our view, was an abuse of discretion. In terms of how he came about with his particular division of property, neither party argued the manner in which the court did it. But in the event that this court found that he was within his discretion to create a reimbursement idea of reimbursing Lawrence his inheritance, which had previously been part of the marital estate, contributed, used as a basis to create the marriage estate as it existed at the time of trial, we believe that the trial court still erred in its way of valuing that particular asset. At trial, the parties...
Should that have been included? Are you saying it should have been included, his prior contribution or his prior inheritance?
We argue that that should have been a factor in determining the parties' perceptions in terms of the whole estate, which included Barbara's inheritance. Because he, at the time of trial, said, I had an inheritance. I threw it in there because that's what we do as a married couple. And just because...
Well, okay. So if it was included, in essence, she's having to pay him back for the entire value of that inheritance under the way the trial court divided the property.
And actually, I think that that's true and untrue. And the reason I say that is because of this, is that what the trial court did is it found a present value of $411,000 at the time of trial for that particular inheritance. It reimbursed Lawrence $160,000 of that inheritance, or 40%. He discounted it by an inflation factor that was not utilized in the valuation of any other asset in that marriage. All of the property values in that marriage were stipulated to you by the parties and included any type of growth.
Okay, but the present-day value, the trial court awarded that entirely to the husband and had to be paid by the wife, the entire amount of the present-day value.
Correct. No, I don't think so, because I think that he awarded the present value, but not the fair market value. And the distinction of that is this, is that if it was included in part of the estate and he was awarded that, and she's awarded her property, all of the property that she got, she can turn around and take full value for that property. She had approximately $1 million worth of real estate after the trial. When she turns around and sells that to a purchaser, she's going to get $1 million. Lawrence, when the trial court says you're entitled to your inheritance back, but you're only going to get less than the fair market value that was established for every other asset at a trial.
Fair market value of cash is cash, isn't it?
I don't think so, because he's discounted it by a factor that was not utilized in any other asset in the property division, and that included cash. Some of the other assets that was divided amongst the parties included cash. And so what we have here is Barbara getting the full value of all of her property that she was awarded. Lawrence gets full value for some of the property he's awarded and then gets a discounted amount for the inheritance that he's been now awarded. Because of the fact that it would have been that value, that fair market value at the time of trial, as found by the trial court made a finding of fact to that extent, and he's only getting $160,000 of that, you know, physics says that matter cannot be created or destroyed. Where is the other $250,000? The person remitting, the obligated party, is the person receiving the benefit from that transaction.
Well, let me ask you another question about physics. I don't see that that money was ever an asset to be divided. Our law is clear that the court is to divide assets as they exist at the time of the trial. That was money that was spent during the course of the marriage. And if we start treating money spent in hypothetical situations, where do we stop? One side's going to say, well, you used to go on fishing trips every year, and you wasted $20,000 a year. If we would have just had that money today, we'd have all this. The other side's going to say, well, you used to go on that trip, or whatever it might be. This wasn't an asset. It wasn't a physical asset to be divided.
I totally agree with you, Justice. In fact, if you look at the appellant brief and the appellee brief, it's one of the few things we agreed on. We found that this was something that occurred out of the blue and kind of took us aback. What I'm simply arguing is that in the event that this court finds that the trial court did not abuse its discretion in engaging in that particular methodology, we have an alternate issue as to how he went about doing it. But I totally agree with the court that engaging in speculation as such does open a floodgate to further litigation. We also believe that the trial court erred in terms of the post-judgment interest factor that it applied. When the amended judgment was entered, it provided for 5% post-judgment interest as of the date of trial, non-pro-tunc. We believe that the trial court erred and that the statute specifically says all judgments should be assessed interest at the Category B rate of 10%.
Now, clarify one thing, though. I couldn't tell from the briefs if the argument was about the delay between the decision and the judgment or the rate of interest after the judgment was entered.
Okay. The delay issue was the appellant's issue. The rate of interest was the appellee's issue. I believe that the appellant waived her issue because it was not preserved. As I said, this appeal is based on the remand proceeding. That particular issue was never raised below at the remand proceeding. Neither was the post-judgment interest rate, but we brought that back before the court by supplemental objections once the court notified us of its decision, and we asked for a motion for reconsideration, thus preserving that particular issue to present it for this court on review. The issue of delay was never reviewed by the court, never had the opportunity to review, and there's case law that says that if the trial court did not have the opportunity to review the issue, it's waived on appeal. And that's our position on that. In terms of the actual statutory interest, they cite Lien v. Lien. Lien v. Lien was decided in 1979. And there's a footnote in that particular case that said that specifically there was no issue raised in this appeal as to whether money judgments in divorce cases bear interest at the rate made applicable to other judgments by statute. That case is not controlling law because that issue specifically was noted by that court. It was not an issue presented for review. If you look at the statute that we're citing is 5435.1. That was enacted and codified in 1981. And as I said before, Lien v. Lien was decided in 1979. This is post-Lien v. Lien statutory language. If you look at the pocket part in 1979, It says that a judgment will be assessed interest at 10%. This is paraphrasing, but does not provide for any exceptions. In 1981, the legislature enacted 5.1 and made two exceptions to the Category B interest rate. Those two exceptions were mortgages and security agreements. Neither one is applicable here. If the legislature had wanted to provide for an exception for divorce judgments, it had the opportunity to do it at that time. And the appellant is asking this court to essentially legislate from the bench and create an exception that does not exist within the plain meaning of the statute.
Don't you agree, though, that the court has power as a part of the property division in making its decision before a judgment's entered, saying, look, you know, I'm going to make you pay 5% or 3% based on this or that and a variety of factors. Can't the trial court do that as a part of its decision before the judgment?
I think the trial court can construct a pre-judgment way of shifting around the equities.
Right.
But once that judgment's in place, the statute controls. And a judge does not have the authority to contravene the statute simply because it thinks it wants to. It has to deal with the law. And like I said, you can do a lot of things pre-judgment and construct the case so that you get the end result of maybe adjusting the statute or the interest rate. But once that judgment is entered, it is what it is.
But you know, divorce judgments, unlike commercial transaction judgments, oftentimes don't have a bottom line figure from which you can do it. It might say transfer the house. It might say you've got a year to sell this and that. How can you apply that kind of a statute to that kind of a judgment?
Let me narrow the context of my argument. We have a specific monetary amount here, and it's a judgment. We believe that 5435.1 applies, that there is no exception to that. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Emerson. Ms. Voigt, you have 10 minutes.
Thank you, Justice. I guess I'll start where Mr. Emerson ended and touch briefly on the interest issue. I think that it's clear from Lane that it may have been decided prior to the statute, but it says in Lane that it gives the authority to the trial court to depart from statutory defaults. So when the statute went into effect that Mr. Emerson is claiming it should fall into, doesn't make lien obsolete. Lien says that the court can depart from statutory defaults. Doesn't matter when that statute was enacted. And part of the interest that he's right, one of the things on the interest part of the appeal here that the appellant is bringing up is that there was untimely delay that was caused by the appellee in this case. It took 3 months to do a findings of facts and conclusions of law, and then it took 11 months to schedule the remand hearing. So there's 14 months that my client then, and by statute, I agree, they get 12 months before they have to file you back for the remand. But, and maybe that's why the lower court chose to take a lower statutory, and that was his way of kind of balancing that out. I want to go back to some of the discussion that Mr. Emerson had with the court on the billion factor and where we go from there. Now, billion talked about direct actions. And Helbersma, we're talking about indirect actions. So as much as Mr. Emerson wants to say, they go hand in hand and billion's just fine and you can still follow it, that's where the confusion lies. Because Billion and Turca and Novak go to the direct actions to the property. And now we have Helbersma saying indirect contributions or indirect actions. In fact, the remand court said that he found that he did not have valuable contributions to it, that he had no direct contributions to the property. So it again goes around that issue of...
I thought he fixed up and repaired and did work around the house.
He did, and that's what he was awarded the $7,500 in the initial trial court, and that's why he still gave him that credit. That's what he was given. But I'm quoting right from the remand decision, is that he found that it was not valuable and that there was no direct contribution. Again, the de minimis property and the indirect contribution, where they fall in, that I'm not here. That's not my job to tell, you know, that's the court's decision to figure out where that comes in. And when it says equitable division of property, I believe that that means, maybe unfortunately for all of us, because I'm on the part of it too, you have to start at the beginning. If you're going to be doing equitable division of property, then you've got to start at the beginning and go through those seven principal factors. And then if you're going to, and Godfrey said, whether you're going to include or exclude, you need to go through those factors. And then Billion goes on, and Novak and Tirsa go on again and say, these are the factors you need to look at to determine inclusion and exclusion. Okay, so once we do the first seven factors, and then we do what I call the Billion factors, right or wrong, then do we do indirect contribution? Do we always do indirect contribution? Those are some of the questions that we look at. We look at, I think you still go to Billion, but then where do we go from there? I believe that in this case that we're looking at maybe coming to full circle, as I said before. We started out with indirect contribution being an indirect contribution to the marriage. Now, is that indirect contribution towards inherited or premarital property always considered? Is it only considered if it's excluded? You know, or is it only excluded if there's de minimis? But it was found to be clearly erroneous that it was de minimis and that you need to take into consideration this indirect contribution. And in my eyes, that's where some of our confusion lies. You know, I don't know if there need to be new factors now that we look at. That, you know, I wouldn't presume to tell the court new factors, but I don't know if we need to go further and say, well, when were they received in the marriage? Were they an integral part of the marriage? Did it change the, what was the standard of living of the parties?
All right, Ms. Boyd, same issue I dealt with or asked Mr. Emerson. When trial court looked at the inherited property, should it have been looking at just the inherited property or again looking at a division of the entire marital estate with the inherited property included?
I don't believe you have any choice, but you have to look at the entire marital property. When you look at inherited property that you, prior to that, excluded, and now you're going to include it, I don't think you have any choice but to go back and have to look at the entire marital estate. As a side note, the plaintiff or the defendant did receive a little bit more marital estate in the original decision. So now if he's getting more of an inherited property that was originally excluded, that again would make sense that you need to go back and look at the whole marital estate. Now, it's my belief that you can't look at it's kind of apples and oranges, but it's not really, because you have to go back and look at that. If you're taking something that, okay, I excluded all of this property before, and this is how I made my marital estate division. Okay, now I'm throwing another 250-some thousand back into the pot, and I'm giving that. Now do we have an inequity that exists because he got more in the marital estate to start out with? That's why I believe if it wasn't included and now it becomes included, you have to go back and start with those seven properties, those seven factors, and look at them initially. And maybe when it comes to inherited property, you have to do that twice. You know, maybe you start out once and you look at the seven factors. Then you go to the Billion and Novak and Tirsa and you apply those as to whether property should be included or excluded. And if you decide that it is included, then maybe you have to go back again and look at the other seven factors as far as the marital estate, because does that change your alignment in the marital state? And that's part of the reason for the appellant's appeal in this, because it did. It shifted $250,000 back to him that was originally not included in, and now is all of a sudden included in the marital estate. I I don't have anything further for the court. For once, I actually do not have anything further to say.
Well, one other question. Do you agree with Mr. Emerson that on the second issue that you agree with him, that before we get to, he's saying, as I understand him, that shouldn't have been reached by the court, but if it was reached, that he should get more money. I'm paraphrasing that. I assume you agree with him?
I do not. I do not agree that he should get more money.
Well, are you agreeing that it shouldn't have been reached in the first place?
Yes. I believe that I smiled when he said that because there wasn't a lot of things that we agreed about in this case, but I think the one thing that we did agree is that this was something that totally came out of the blue and should not have been included as part of the indirect contribution. And if the court does decide, I just don't think that it should be in at all. It was not a marital estate. It was not a marital asset. It wasn't around at the time of trial. It wasn't considered. It was commingled. Those were his choices, what he used them for. So I think we both agree that it was an abuse of discretion for the court to do that. I don't believe that he should receive that much amount of money, obviously, so I don't believe that he should receive more.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Boyd.
Thank you.
We'll be in recess until 10 a.m.